Welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage as we travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, co-founder, executive director, and chief economist of Earth Economics, David Batker. He gave the keynote address at the annual Matsu Salmon Science and Conservation Symposium held this year in Palmer. His talk on ecosystem services, healthy communities, and healthy economies was recorded at the Palmer Community Center on November 13th.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. You know, ICER did a study in 2001 that basically indicated that nearly a third of all jobs in Alaska are relying on based on maintaining a vigorous and healthy natural environment and ecosystems in Alaska, and that generated nearly $2.6 billion in income annually. The report goes on to say that as development occurs, population increases, habitat degrades elsewhere in the world, the value of our functioning ecosystems will become even more valuable over time. Obviously, the full value of these our functioning ecosystems is more than just jobs and more than just income, but really determining and defining and understanding what those true values are is very difficult. And we're very happy today to have Mr. David Batker, who is the chief economist and an executive director and co-founder of Earth Economics, to begin to explore these concepts with us a little bit more, drawing from his international experience working with over 40 different countries on these concepts, to help us begin to understand the value of these services in terms of what's important to us in our communities, whether it's hunting and fishing, subsistence, jobs, food security, drinking water, or what have you. Mr. Batker completed his graduate training in economics under Herman Daly, one of the world's foremost ecological economists. Leading the Earth Economics team, David pioneered innovative studies showing the value of natural systems for buffering hurricanes and floods. And now FEMA is using that research and information in nearly all the post-storm FEMA expenditure decisions and how they respond to natural disasters. David is working nationally to look at accounting rules and how do we account for natural systems that produce and filter water. He's advised the U.S. government on the greening of nearly half a million federal buildings. He's working with Earth Economics to develop practical web-based tools that would allow all of us to begin to understand and begin to calculate the value of nature's benefits. Which hopefully will stimulate new mechanisms for funding conservation. And again, he's worked in over 40 different countries, and he's also co-author of the book entitled, What's the Economy For Anyway? And it's ranked in the top 10 economic and business books by the New York Book Review. So once again, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Mr. David Batker, who will be with us today for the keynote as well as for other parts of this session. Thank you.
Thank you, David, and thank you for the invitation to be here. I really appreciate it. You know, I think it's really worthwhile that we're looking at healthy communities, healthy salmon. When you reflect on it, there are these middens in the Caucasus. People were eating salmon 50,000 years ago. So the idea that you have healthy salmon and healthy communities isn't new. When you think about that, people have been eating salmon for almost seven times as long as we've had agriculture. And here in North America, at least five or six times as long as we've had agriculture. So we can't throw a resource like that away easily. We need to think about salmon, its value, and the fact that salmon is an iconic species. When that salmon are healthy, you know your watershed is healthy, your oceans are healthy. You've got a much larger healthy system. So I'm going to talk today about ecosystem services. And you know, when I went to graduate school in economics, this is sort of what they taught us, that the economy is the big thing. And the environment's the little thing. And if you look at the gross domestic product, if you added up all our fisheries, all our forestry, if you added up agriculture and minerals, all those kind of natural resource areas, it's about 2%, 2 to 3% of the GDP. So not too much, really. In fact, one economist once said, you know, if climate change and agriculture goes away, it's okay. It's not that big a piece of the GDP anyway. And yet, it's our food. So, in fact, the real picture is a lot more like this. And that is that every economy is housed within a watershed. Every economy is set within natural systems. And if those systems, that green part, starts falling apart, it's pretty hard to keep the other system in shape. And so when you think about this watershed, it's impressive. Because one thing you've really got going for you is the burrow sort of matches pretty close the size of the watershed. That's not what we have in most of the U.S. or the world. And so already, the Matsu, you're set to have kind of the right scale of even governance to solve problems here. But think about that. Again, all our towns and things, they're within that watershed. That system has to be healthy to have a healthy economy. And nowhere is it more true than here in the valley. Think about this watershed. How many jurisdictions are in that watershed? That's the Mississippi Basin. Thousands of counties, thousands of cities, a huge number of states, 41%. I'm going to talk just for a minute about this little corner right here, Louisiana, to show what happens if we lose the healthiness of our natural systems. And I was down in Louisiana for about 5 years. I'm from Washington State, and I grew up catching an awful lot of salmon, I have to say. In fact, this year we had the biggest pink run in the Puyallup River since 1932. So it's nice to have some salmon runs that are still really doing well. This is New Orleans, is right here, Crescent City. This is the Delta of the Mississippi, and this is what's happened to it. We've lost 1.4 million acres of wetlands since 1930, gone, because we channeled all that sediment and fresh water right off the continental shelf. So there was no more renewal of those of that wetlands. And also we kind of drilled these oil canals in, so salt water came up. Then they forced directional drilling, which is a much better option. Here was Hurricane Katrina, came breezing in. It was just a little tropical storm initially, but the Gulf is hot. It was more than 10 degrees hotter than the 1970s. So in the 1970s, this would have remained kind of a small storm, but hurricanes gained power over open water, and hot water became a Category 5. And then it hit the coast, and because I worked on hurricane buffering earlier, they called me down just a couple weeks after Hurricane Katrina. You know, tremendous damage. The natural system fell apart. You can't have an economy without it. And so we had 1,400 people killed in 24 hours, $200 billion worth of damage, just like that. And you know what's odd? Is that when they were talking about restoring the Mississippi Delta, they said it would cost, you know, $20 to $25 billion. That's outrageous. We're not going to spend $25 billion restoring the Mississippi Delta. That was the attitude. And then we had $200 billion damage just in one storm. Then we had Hurricane Rita. Then Hurricane Ike. Then Hurricane Gustav. One after another. So, you know, about 250. Almost over 200,000 people moved away from that area. Louisiana lost one congressional seat. So when you think about the Matsu, we're going to have a lot more people here. People are moving in here. How do we keep the character of this place intact? How do we keep these natural systems, salmon, intact? Really crucial question about economic development. Economies never sit still. They're always changing. And so you have to have kind of an active planning. You need to think about how things are going to happen. Otherwise, you kind of end up potentially in a place you don't want to be. Well, fortunately, this was the flood of 2011, and all that brown, they opened up three big diversions and pushed sediment out back out just to prevent flooding in New Orleans. Now we knew, no, actually, that's a big piece of the solution. And I was on an advisory committee to Louisiana for 2 years, a scientific and technical committee. If you put about 7-15 big diversions in there, move that sediment back out, you can rebuild that delta. And Louisiana, to its credit, is probably going to be the most aggressive state, in fact, restoration project in history, really moving toward restoration. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit more here about Matsu. Again, this is a huge area. It's an area that's fragile in a lot of ways. It can be destroyed, just like people never thought you could destroy the Mississippi Delta, and we managed to. 1.4 million acres gone. So we got to think very carefully about how we handle these forests. In fact, the Mississippi Delta, those wetlands, they valued them at about $150 an acre. But then, if you calculate when a hurricane comes in, for every 2.5 miles of wetlands, you take 1 foot off the storm surge of a hurricane. That's a lot. In fact, with Hurricane Katrina, it came in with a 29-foot storm surge, but even with half the wetlands there, by the time it hit New Orleans, it was a 16-foot storm surge, still enough to destroy the city. But had the original 60 miles of wetlands been there, probably wouldn't have done much damage. Now, why did we count those wetlands as worth zilch? That bugged the hell out of me, I have to say. And we kind of treat salmon that way, too. If you look at Tacoma, Washington, where I grew up and where I'm from, there's a big port there. And they'll bring in all these cars from Japan, and there's a gigantic parking lot with thousands of cars. And that's worth something. Those cars are actually valued. They all have that value of tens of thousands of dollars. And yet, salmon in the ocean, that stock of value, just like that stock of automobiles, counts as zero. Now, there's something a little bit wrong with that. And so that's why we embarked on this big project with partnering with the Nature Conservancy and a lot of other folks here, David Wigglesworth as well, to look at the value of the natural systems in the Matsu. And maybe you won't be surprised that you're a wealthy people here. And Maya, my colleague, Maya Kosian, is going to talk a lot more about that valuation in just a while. So I'll be talking a little more generally. But you think about the recreational value, the quality of life, flood risk reduction. Here's the 2012. I was back over here just right after the flood in Talkeetna. And these natural systems hold up. They both protect us and also provide great value. So I'm going to talk about ecosystem services. So these are kind of like the benefits of nature. And if there's no place that it's more apparent, it's right here in the valley. It's really crucial. People's food comes from here. Their natural resources, heating with wood, quality of life, recreation, you name it. It's really, we live much closer to nature. So flood risk reduction, as David mentioned, after the disaster in Hurricane Katrina and then more floods across the U.S., we worked with FEMA, and one of the things about FEMA that they didn't recognize the value of floodplains for storing and holding floodwaters in their economics. That makes a big deal. As I say, nature has been sort of undervalued, underseen in our values. So if you can widen out the floodway above or below Talkeetna or other places, you can actually reduce flooding in Talkeetna. So FEMA, in June 2013, adopted ecosystem service valuation, just like Maya is going to talk about in a little while, in all of their economic analysis. So for every house that gets damaged, for every road, everything else, they take into account where is that. If that house is moved out, I help people to move out, and then you widen that, open that floodway up, then it provides greater flood risk reduction. And FEMA has figured they're going to save billions and billions of dollars for the taxpayer by applying ecosystem service evaluation. And not just for the taxpayer, actually for homeowners and others. I can talk about that a little bit later. Then you think about pollination. Bees, Maya was just saying, you know, the bee is the $50, it's like a $50 bill that flies, pollinating things. Really important service. Recreation and tourism, fresh water supply comes out of nature. This is the yew tree native to southeast Alaska and down by Washington. Well, a lot of times the value of natural systems are hard to notice. And we don't know how much value is there until actually, you know, we discover something we didn't know before. Taxol is from the bark of the yew tree, and that is the best known cure right now for breast cancer and about 20 other cancers. So when you think about valuing ecosystem services also, often our dollar values are below the true value. So just think about Taxol. Yeah, there's a dollar value for what people pay for it, and it's in the billions, so it's worth a lot. On the other hand, how much more is it worth for children to have their moms around longer, for those women to live longer, for partners to have their husbands or their wives live longer, or their husbands, depending on what kind of cancer? So that quality of life, the value there kind of dwarfs the dollar value. But often, all we can kind of measure is that dollar value. And again, habitat and nursery value, food. So I'm going to talk a little bit more about these ecosystem services, and then Maya's going to talk about the valuation we did. There's some sort of categories of ecosystem services. One are the things that we call goods. Those are things you could drop on your toe, like a salmon or a gallon of water. That's provisioning up there services. Goods are things that we trade in markets, and they have dollar value. It's kind of easy to calculate. On the other hand, when I catch a sockeye salmon and feed my family, it doesn't come into the market system, but we sure get a lot of value out of it. And then regulating services, those are certain things that you can't drop on your toe, and I'll talk about them in a minute. Cultural services, and finally this category, supporting services, that's like nutrient cycling, kind of big areas of value, and it contributes to our health and well-being. Well, again, provisioning functions, these are like goods, things you could drop on your toe that come out of nature, and they're worth a lot. Food, medicinal, 85% of our medicines come from plant-based sources. We wouldn't have even found them if they weren't in plants. Fiber, minerals, timber, fuel, all those things are easily valued in dollar terms. Then we can look at regulating services, such as flood risk reduction, climate change, climate stability, waste treatment, water quality, soil erosion control, soil formation, water regulation, biological control, having pest, control of pests and such. These services were once very hard to figure out a dollar value for, but these days it's not hard. We've got it all figured out. Economists basically have methods for valuing these services quite well. Just like I say, for New Orleans, or in fact for mudflats in Alaska, mudflats are very valuable. They take that wave, as soon as it hits that shallow water, the wave builds up, crashes, and you reduce that wave impact. So mudflats provide hurricane or storm protection and tsunami protection. In the tsunami in Southeast Asia, it's very interesting. Where you had coral reefs, mudflats, and mangroves, communities were less impacted. In some communities, incredibly hardly impacted. They have some mangrove areas that had 40-foot mangroves, so they did well. And Shana just mentioned that disaster in the Philippines. I was in Tacloban a few years ago. It's the provincial capital. It's like Anchorage. That is a big city. And unfortunately, you know, the mangroves were cut down and the coral reefs lost with some dynamite fishing and such. And so the storm impact was much larger than it would have been without that. And it's a tremendous tragedy. And those things, you know, is that coastline of the Philippines even going to be inhabitable if we have larger and larger and more frequent storms? That's a tough question. Supporting services are services that kind of back everything else up, like nutrient cycle, net primary production. So that's like the phosphorus cycle, the nitrogen cycle, biodiversity and habitat. These are much harder to value. It's harder to figure out sort of a dollar value for some of these. Sometimes we can. So this is an area of really active research. And another thing you'll find, because this area is new, ecosystem service valuation, we're finding services of value that still there are sort of no valuation studies. I'm stunned on the west coast of the U.S., Washington, Oregon, and California, there are no studies really of the value of snowpack, and yet 4/5 of our drinking water is held as snowpack, 1/5 behind dams. And if you think of the potential of losing that snowpack with a warming climate, it's a huge cost for us. So we're looking at doing a few more of those primary studies. And finally, cultural functions, aesthetic value, recreation, spiritual, cultural value, just like Patricia was talking about, really incredible. Some things we don't know how to value in dollar terms, maybe we shouldn't. Spiritual value, aesthetic value. We can capture part of it. If you have a view of the mountains with your house value is a little higher. Me, I don't have a view, for instance, of Mount Rainier down in Washington, but I sure get a lot of aesthetic value out of it. So it's easy to count that dollar value of increased property value. And here, there's a strong tie, as some of the studies that that ICER is looking at and that we're looking at in our report, to property value and the health of those natural systems and your proximity to natural systems. That's really important to keep thinking about. Well, now, how would we look at these values all together? I mean, we're piling things like pounds of salmon and flood risk reduction and cultural value and such. That seems crazy to lump all those things together. They don't even have the same unit. Well, that really doesn't bother economists much because we kind of throw it all into dollar value and put it together. And that has some strengths and weaknesses, of course, because you can't really substitute flood risk reduction for food in truth. Those things are separate. On the other hand, it's a good idea if you want to understand the value of a capital asset like your house, you do want to understand, is the roof in good shape? How many rooms does it have? How many bathrooms? We want to know kind of the full suite of benefits that it provides. So I'm going to zip along here. Again, this is a huge watershed and has tremendous value and a stock of value that in the past we haven't seen. I want to just give you my 42nd history of economics here, a lesson. Think about this. Before the 1930s, all we had was microeconomics, and that was the economics of markets, households, looking at firms. That's important economics. We still use that. How many people should you hire in a firm before it's too many? How many products should you produce? How many cars do you produce? And then say, we're not going to produce any more. We'd flood the market. That's an important set of questions. Well, then we hit the Depression. All of a sudden, factories were closed. It was a national scale disaster. We had no national scale measures. There was no measure of gross domestic product, didn't exist. No measure of inflation, no measure of the dollar supply, no measure of unemployment nationally. We decided, hey, those things are pretty important. We need to measure that. And so we created a whole new suite of measures and a whole new economics. That's called macroeconomics. That looks at the scale of the economy as the nation. And yet, just as we were blind to how much stuff we produced and the value of it before the GDP, we've been blind to most of the value that's been produced in this valley and the Mat-Su. We've been blind to the fact we do not measure the value of that stock of salmon and how healthy it is in dollar value, whereas we certainly do that with cars in an inventory of cars, even though they're not on the lot yet for sale. So I think one of the great advancements, and it's why we call Earth economics, is starting to take notice of this value of natural systems, because if we don't do that in the 21st century, all of our economies are in big trouble. Just like New Orleans, those natural systems fall apart and we end up in tough shape. I'll give you one more example. I'm kind of on a disaster because I've been working with FEMA quite a bit. It's been one disaster after another, I have to say. Well, here's Hurricane Sandy off the northeast coast, came in, demolished the coastline. But there's a little story here that's a bit different from Louisiana. This was ground zero, you know, seawater flooding in there. They had to put sandbags about this tall around Wall Street. Otherwise, it would have flooded the New York Stock Exchange. Well, what does this forest have to do with Hurricane Sandy? Hurricane Sandy hit New York and New Jersey. In New York, incredibly, because the water supply is supplied from the Catskill Mountains. No filtration plants, it's clean enough. The whole supply is gravity fed. The day of the hurricane, Mike Bloomberg, the mayor, tweeted, New York tap water, absolutely safe to drink. Through the whole disaster, you could drink the water. Turn on the tap and drink it. Gravity fed, filtered by the forest. On the other hand, the very same day, almost the same time, Governor Christie had this declared a water emergency because in New Jersey, it's all pumps, pipes. The pumps went down, the filtration plants went down, the pumps that still worked sucked in sewage because the sewage plants had been impacted. You couldn't drink the water out of the tap. If you had water at the tap, you had to boil it. And so think about that. And there's some real economic implications. That is, it's going to cost about $2.6 billion to fix the water systems in New Jersey, and it's going to cost almost nothing to fix the water infrastructure in New York. Wow! So when you think about this valley and harnessing, keeping in good shape these natural systems, it's healthy salmon, healthy watersheds, healthy communities, healthy economies. You're more robust, more resilient, really crucial. So when we think about these natural systems, they're not sort of just waste out there. They're providing value already. And that value is important to measure, because if we don't measure it, suddenly we're going to lose it. And then we're going to find ourselves, like New Jersey, having to do a lot of repairs, potentially. Here's one example, TNC, just on culverts. This is the old culvert. These culverts don't perform well in floods. The Talkeetna flood, they get washed out. This was, in fact, replaced with a salmon-friendly culvert. Well, one good thing about salmon-friendly culverts that the Nature Conservancy, they're good in floods because they're wide at the bottom. So debris, instead of getting caught up in that narrow portion of the bottom, washes right through. So this dollar for dollar, this is a good culvert, whether you're talking about salmon or keeping your road in shape, making sure your road doesn't wash out. These performed better in the flood, Talkeetna flood. So when we're thinking about value again, we gotta have the right perspective with natural systems. You can kind of work with nature, or you can work against it. And Mother Nature is pretty tough to work against. This is the Puyallup River Valley, where I'm from. That's Mount Rainier and Tacoma here. It's got three big areas, and it's got, I think, a very important lesson for policy for the Matanuska. One of the lessons is that we tried to control this river in a big way. The U.S. and the county and the state have spent about $1 billion since 1920 trying to levy this river in and control it. And the problem is this. It comes down from about 14,400 feet in 42 miles to zero elevation. That's pretty hard to control. So of course it comes down, it goes, demolishes this levee and you know, takes out some area when it starts getting too big. You have to give a river room. There's no other way about it. And so finally, Pierce County is ranked second in the nation of all the counties and boroughs in the country now for flood risk reduction policies. That's because they adopted a no build in the river migration zone. So this river, you can tell where it's going to move, what land it's going to chop out. And it's worth a lot of money not to have people build there. I mean, it was kind of tragic when I was up here just right after the Talkeetna flood, because you can see driveways that went to the river. It used to be a house there. Now it's just a driveway. And so it's a very bad economic policy to build things where they're going to get demolished. It simply, and one philosophy is, hey, if people want to build somewhere, let them go build there. But that costs the borough a lot of money. It costs the other taxpayers money. Because what happens is, just like floods here, you end up with a power line that is just chopped off. Somebody has to go out there and pay to fix that power line. You get a septic tank that got just rubbled out of the ground and needs to be taken care of, and emergency services, etc. So in truth, disasters cost everybody a lot. And then you try and build things again. If you build it right back in the same spot, gets demolished again, you're not building a very healthy economy. So I feel that one policy you might consider here is, again, no build in the river migration zone. It's local people making decisions about local policy. And it is better for the homeowners as well over the long run.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with David Batker, co-founder, executive director, and chief economist of Earth Economics. He gave the keynote address on ecosystem services, healthy communities, and healthy economies at this year's Matsu Salmon Science and Conservation Symposium. His talk was recorded at the Palmer Community Center on November 13, 2013.
One of the things that FEMA looked at, 33,000 houses with repetitive flooding. Very interesting study. What they showed was that people, if you FEMA used to say, you cannot move your house. You have to stay where you are. We'll just help you rebuild part of it because it's cheaper than helping somebody move out. Even though 85% of the people who have flooding the first time want to move out. On the second flood, it's about 98% of people want to move out from their house. But they got a mortgage. They can't move out. So where there was repetitive flooding, people actually had a shorter lifespan. Because when you get a big rain, you've had 5 feet of water in your house once, tremendous trauma, you get a big rain, you're worried about it. There's a lot of anxiety. It actually shortens people's lives. So now FEMA is saying, if people want to move out, it's a better policy to get them moved out so you don't have repetitive flooding. And if you look at an individual's costs for a flood, you've got a mortgage you have to pay off, then you have flood damage, and then you have bigger costs now because you just had to fix up the house, but you already got a lot of sunk costs. The personal costs of that flood damage is very severe. Anyway, thinking about that, those policies, as you have growth in this valley, how can this growth take place where you don't have part of that growth demolished? Another thing is that no migration zone is good for salmon. Because that where those floods take place, that's where you get gravel deposited, which is the right size for salmon spawning. So they realize that no migration zone build area is also good for salmon as well. And it's good for the economy in Pierce County. It actually costs less. We calculated the dollar value saved on one flood because there wasn't building in a particular area. Here's another case where ecosystem services can be used. Really important. When you think about the borough, what kind of benefit cost analysis? So in Alaska, if you build a road, if you build a bridge, etc., we generally do a benefit cost analysis to show that the economics are worth building it. This is a case in Washington State, Tolt River setback. This is the Tolt River here coming into the Snoqualmie River. This is how it was in 1937. We had very healthy Chinook salmon run, in fact, at that time. Then we put levees in and made that river pipe. When you levee in river, you make it pipe, you give it more power because that water comes zooming down that pipe and it has more power to destroy levees or do flooding further down. It can't spread out, it can't doesn't have room. So we did a benefit cost analysis with the county and with Seattle Public Utilities. If this was only a flood risk reduction project, probably wouldn't have been enough benefits to get it done. If it was only a salmon restoration project, again, probably wouldn't have passed the economic test. But when you looked at salmon benefits, flood risk reduction, this is a park here, so recreation benefits, et cetera, actually it came out to be a very good, about a return to 6-1 on the investment. So this was the plan to move the levee over, and they did it. We did the calculations and they did it, they moved it over. And this was a flood, and in fact, it added 50 acres of storage and reduced flooding downstream. If they do this, widen this floodplain out a little further up, you'd reduce flooding down further even more. And it was successful as a Chinook restoration area. We had a lot more Chinook spawning there. Another project was the Salmon Northwinds Weir. So when you think about this, what's happening here is communities did the wrong thing. They messed up the river. They goofed up salmon habitat, and now at pretty stiff cost, we've got to put things at least a little bit closer to where it was. Now, in the Matanuska Susitna, we still have the situation in pretty good shape. It hasn't been messed up yet. You haven't invested $1 billion kind of doing the wrong thing, and now having to invest hundreds of million dollars to try to fix it again. And the same here. But here's another case where widening this area out, there was a steering committee in the Green River of 90 people. They included 16 cities from Black Diamond, Tea Party Black Diamond down to, liberal Seattle. And they had a steering committee of 70 people. They couldn't agree on this restoration project. But after we showed that actually you get salmon restoration and you get flood risk reduction, it was unanimously approved by the group. It was one of their first unanimous votes. And I went up to the chairwoman and I said, hey, that was pretty impressive. They all voted in favor of it. She said, well, that's because this has multiple benefits. And so I think thinking about economic development, it's very crucial. In fact, this is right on this side is Boeing manufacturing. At first, Boeing wasn't too big on this idea. And then I met with a vice president at Boeing, and I said, is your biggest threat to Boeing Airbus, or is it a flood in the Green River Valley? And he sat back and went, you know, we got so many orders of planes in the future, we're not really worried about Airbus, it doesn't matter. But yeah, a flood, it would shut down our production line, you know, obviously that would do a lot more damage to us. And in fact, Boeing donated some land to increase this salmon restoration. So this is the project after it was done. Another idea we've had, which again, the Matsu is you're ahead of the curve big time because you're already at the basin scale. The scale of the watershed is at the scale of the jurisdiction for the borough. We worked with these, this is just a little context, you know, Washington State up there. Here's Puget Sound, and this is the Green River. Seattle's over here, the Green River Valley. Why do we have to think about this as our economic boundary? This is where a huge amount of economic production power is located. Drinking water all comes out of here. Flood risk reduction, salmon, huge stormwater here. And one thing we realized in this valley, now, if you lose an ecosystem service, you gain a tax district. So you used to have stormwater that was percolated into the ground as it was fun. Now, fine, now we pave it over. Got to have a stormwater district. We used to have shellfish that were just fine on their own. Now we're contaminating, causing problems. You get a shellfish district. It's kind of incredible, the proliferation of tax districts, because we goof up with nature. So right here, this is 16 cities, all kinds of politics in that one watershed. How many tax districts do you think are in that picture? Anybody want to hazard a guess? 150 tax, school districts, park districts, stormwater districts, flood district, you know, goes on and on. And so what we said is, why can't we kind of rationalize this a little bit and think about a watershed investment district where instead of, right now in this area, you've got 16 stormwater districts building pipes into the river, get that water out of Kent, get that water out of Auburn, we need to push it into the Green River. And then you have the same people in this whole area paying another tax to the flood district, and the flood district going, hey, we're getting more water every year. What's going on? We're getting higher peak flows. Well, sure, we're draining everything off faster. So if you think about it, you know, we have to be economically efficient about what we're doing. So in this case, we proposed a watershed investment district. The group, again, Tea Party, Black Diamond, right down to Liberal Seattle, said unanimously, we like this idea. This is our, we want to move forward with the Watershed Investment District. We have drafted legislation, and this year the legislature, last year, passed a bill to do a study session to create a Watershed Investment District. I hope it's going to move forward here, and I think, because if you think about the amount of money spent in all those tax districts, if you said, why can't the flood district pay a little bit to the stormwater district so that they put the water back in the ground? That's good for salmon for the low flow period. It's good for drinking water. It's good for flood risk reduction. Instead of having one investment conflict with another and demolish another infrastructure, we can have a much better economy if we just rationalize from the Army Corps all the way to the city of Kent, you know, our investments in that watershed. So again, you've got the opportunity, a growing population, to think about this watershed as one unit and not to make the mistakes of a lot of other places of saying, well, now we lost another, even Texas, it amazes me how many tax districts in a very anti-tax district place there are, because Houston withdrew too much groundwater, the land subsided. The Houston River flooded one of their most important sites, historic sites, which is where a battle was fought when Texas was an independent country. Now it's all underwater. They had to create a subsidence tax district to stop subsidence. I mean, it was incredible, but you know, you're kind of forced to. If you lose nature's benefits for free, you're forced to go that route. Well, Now, so in this case, we're moving ahead kind of with the Watershed Investment District, and fortunately, you've kind of got yourself already at the scale to handle these problems. And I think that's really important, because when you think about ecosystem services, they're different the way they're distributed across the landscape. I mean, that's why salmon are so incredible. They go from the upper watershed all the way out to the Bering Sea. And so you think about the range, the map of that, what that animal covers, just completely incredible. Whereas flood risk reduction, you know the area that is Talkeetna, for example, for the down areas, where you receive the benefit of flood risk reduction. Aesthetic views, again, it's a different mapping. Earth Economics, we had a grant from the National Science Foundation, which was really terrific, a 3-year grant, to look at how do you map where the benefits are provided in natural systems and who the beneficiaries are. This is really important to think about. What is the provisioning set of assets in this watershed for salmon, for flood risk reduction, for drinking water, for wildlife, for hunting, for duck hunting, moose hunting, for recreation? That gives us a new view. Just like in 1930, we had no view of how things were produced in this country. In fact, probably one reason the U.S. was so powerful in World War II is because we'd created measures of where things were produced in this country. Our government knew where copper was produced, how much and where, so they could marshal all that stuff. Well, again, this, how can we can have a vision now in the Matsu of where value is provided. Maya's going to give more detail on that soon. So we can kind of map these things, provisioning benefits, water beneficiaries, who are the beneficiaries with water supply, et cetera, coastal flood protection. And now you're getting a better view of how the economy actually works. And this is very exciting. We've had a lot of folks interested in this, particularly lately with FEMA, and thinking about how you build, where you build, how you do things better so that your economy is more robust. Here are some other applications of ecosystem service valuation. As David said, we're looking at accounting. As someone, as I say, who I've spent so much time fishing, it kind of makes me dizzy, but it was all happy hours, and with my kids as well. Why is it that a stock of fish has zero value out there in the ocean, but a stock of cars sitting on the pavement in Tacoma has a lot of value? Our accounting is a little bit goofed up there. We need to change that accounting. We're working right now with the Governmental Accounting Services Board that sets accounting rules looking at utilities and water. Consider this. Seattle Public Utilities owns the whole watershed, but it only shows up because it produces water that over 1 million people drink, and yet that value of that watershed for producing water is zero on their books. It's only bare land and timber value. So we're thinking about how we can improve accounting rules, and basically we've said there's an inconsistency here. And I, by the way, I was a geologist also, and I worked in the fifth largest coal mine in the U.S., and I've also worked in the oil industry. And one of the things about the oil industry is if I am the chief financial officer in Exxon, I have to record my natural capital. How much oil is in that ground, my best estimate, and the dollar value of it. I have to have natural capital on my balance sheet, otherwise I'd go to jail. On the other hand, if Seattle Public Utilities put the value of its natural capital, the value of the watershed for producing drinking water, on its books, then the CFO would go to jail. So we pointed out this discrepancy with a bunch of utilities, San Francisco, New York, they've all kind of joined this effort. And the General Accounting Services Board has said, that is a problem. And one of the problems is that, I could talk about that maybe in questions, but it changes the economics. You can, you could build a filtration plant, take a bond out if you're your utility, build a filtration plant, it shows up on your accounting sheet, you raise your rates, you can pay for it. There's a funding mechanism for investment in a filtration plant, just like New Jersey had. On the other hand, if, like Seattle, you want to remove some roads and take a bond out to do that, it doesn't count. And so you can't use the same funding mechanism. And so what we want to do is open up the same kind of funding mechanisms that we have for built capital for natural capital restoration. And so anyway, benefit cost analysis, environmental impact assessment. We did the first environmental impact assessment, which include valuation of ecosystem services. And I just wanted to mention with that, a lot of people feel very uncomfortable, and I admit I did too, about valuation of ecosystem services. Because, you know, some of these systems, they're of infinite value. So how can we put a dollar value to that? Well, I kind of liken it to thinking about a person's life. A person's life is invaluable. You can't put, even though FEMA does put $5.4 million is the value of a person's life, that's what they say, but really it's invaluable. On the other hand, we do work, right? And I appreciate getting my paycheck, as probably everybody else does. And so when we talk about valuation, this is not talking about so that intrinsic value of nature, but we're just kind of talking about at least give nature the credit for the work it does. And so that's really what we're talking about there. And another thing about natural capital, think about this watershed, it appreciates in value. So when Seattle acquired its watershed, the Cedar River, in 1889, it didn't produce that much water for people to drink because there weren't that many people there. Over the years, it's had more and more drinking water, and every gallon is worth more. It's become more and more and more valuable. And on the other hand, if we would have had a filtration plant in Seattle instead of the forest filtering the water, we'd have had to build four of them. So natural capital appreciates. Think about salmon. Loggers went on strike because they were fed too much salmon 100 years ago in 1913. It was considered kind of junk protein, you might say, at that time. Now, I mean, Chinook salmon, I was stunned. In Seattle, they had some sold for $32 a pound. That just, even that gave me a shock. But, or you buy, get a little piece in the of Chinook or sockeye at a restaurant, and you know, it's a $25 plate right there. So natural capital has appreciated. Whereas you think about built capital, I mean, like plastic toys, they seem to proliferate all over the place. Plastic toys just aren't worth what they used to be because there's so many of them. And so natural built capital is in many ways declining in relative value, and we need the economics to reflect that. So a few other things, jobs analysis, as David mentioned, you look at Alaska and the tie to jobs and salmon, it's incredible, and we need to pay attention to that. We need to, you look at the value of natural systems and their healthy functioning. Alaska is probably the most job-dependent state. Of course, all jobs, from my perspective, are dependent on natural systems. Everything in this room, paint, lights, timber, metal, all came from nature. So it all came from nature originally, and we've added our labor, our technology to it. But Alaska is probably more apparently dependent on jobs. And then funding mechanisms for conservation, restoration, really important. We're thinking about how do you look at flood risk reduction in many areas of the country. An investment in flood risk reduction, like a big levee in the Chehalis Basin, for example, $140 million, that's the biggest investment that's coming into that watershed. And so can we look at something with maybe a lower levee and more restoration of forests up above? It's going to hire more people, actually produce better long-term flood risk reduction and more benefits over time with salmon restoration, and then rate of return on investment. Well, I got just a few more things here to talk about. So if you'd like a copy of my book, What's the Economy For Anyway? I got a few of them out there. It's a little bit humorous, won't give you nightmares. It's not really a gloom and doom book. It's actually saying, you know, natural systems, looking at new measures are very, very important. And then I have a little, and all the proceeds go to Earth Economics, our little nonprofit. So then we have a little film, which is 40 minutes. Also, what's the economy for anyway? But let me just tie up. I had a couple of other things I wanted to say, and then let's have questions here. I want you to think also about the chain of value with natural systems. It's good that water is cheap. What happens when water gets really expensive, like some places in this world? Boy, it's tough on the economy all the way down the line because it's a necessity for industry, for agriculture, for households. So we want salmon to be abundant. We want clean water to be abundant. We want flood risk, flood protection to be abundant. These natural systems have to be abundant to have a healthy economy. And it means we have to manage ourselves and our natural systems better. Next week, I was invited over to, a surprise to me, but I was invited over to Washington, D.C., to the Executive Office of the President to talk to the Office of Budget and Management and Council on Environmental Quality. Now, the Office of Budget and Management is what looks over all the agencies and says, you know, you didn't do the right economic analysis, you're spending your money wrong, or you wasted money, or whatever. And that Office of Budget and Management is kind of caught up, and really it was this work with FEMA. They went, FEMA, what are you doing? You're all this ecosystem service stuff is coming around. This is a really important case. What about the other federal agencies? And so I'm invited over there to talk, and there's quite a debate in economics. And you know, I'm going to talk about the Matsu Basin when I go over there next week, because one philosophy is you're overvaluing those salmon. You know, they're not worth as much as some of you environmental economists or whatever are saying. And yet, one of my perspectives is, why don't we just treat natural systems the way we treat kind of industrial products? If we treated a brand new car, just the way we value salmon, think about it. A car, the reason it's priced at, you know, $30,000 or so for a car is because you paid for all that production process, the glass, the steel, the rubber, the plastic, all the stuff went into it. Salmon, what we really pay for is you go out there, whether it's a commercial fisherman or recreational, you catch this already completed product, the salmon, and then convey it either to the market or to your dinner table. And so if we use the same kind of valuation system for cars that we do for salmon, you'd say basically the value of a car in Wasilla should be the transportation cost from where it was produced over here. So it might be $700 from Japan or to have it shipped from Detroit. Well, that's a pretty low price. And so there's a difference between price, which is what you pay in the market, and value that you get out of it. And that is an important difference to pay attention to. Salmon is a very valuable product. We've had a natural system that put all the steel, you know, the scales, the bones, the meat on the flesh on the bone together. And that system has got to have value, just like a factory has value producing a car. Otherwise, you're going to lose it. What would happen if we just didn't pay for glass in a car? Well, people wouldn't manufacture glass. So this discussion about how we value natural systems and how we invest in their management and such is really a crucial set of decisions. And for me, it's going to make the difference in the 21st century, whether we really have a declining economy in this country or a rising economy and a rising quality of life. The challenge of the 20th century was really taking stuff from nature and making tables and chairs and cars and roads and wires out of it. The challenge in the 21st century is paying attention to those natural systems that produce so many goods and services for us, giving that value, just as we did in the 1930s to things like GDP, and paying attention to it in development. So with that, I guess I'll tie up and we'll have a few minutes only 3 or 4 minutes for questions. Sorry to leave so little for questions, but anybody have discussion or thoughts? Let me just throw one thing out. One thing, I had a big meeting with these federal agencies, and you know, I did this project, as David mentioned, with the governmental, the government agency that basically takes care of all government buildings, GSA, Government Services Administration. The U.S. government has 436,000 buildings. And my first bit of advice was, if you reduce that by 15%, you could save a lot, because a lot of buildings aren't as efficiently used as they could be. But the thing is, Every one of those 436,000 buildings has a value, an asset value. Maya's going to talk about the asset value of the Matsu Basin in just a few minutes. That means you have a maintenance and operations budget with it. Just like this building or any building, you have about 1-4% that goes for operations and management. And then we have institutions like Fish and Wildlife or NOAA that have vast assets we have to look at, like the fish in the Bering Sea or the Gulf of Alaska, you know, or Prince William Sound. That's a lot of value. It's a huge stock of value, and yet we don't treat it the same. And so we don't always have the kind of operations and maintenance budget that we need for natural systems. And then what happens? You get collapsed fisheries. Things fall apart because we didn't manage them as well as we should. So anyway, a few.
We have, I have to pay the gatekeeper here. We have time for one more question.
I guess what I would ask is, this is probably a huge question, but what kind of impacts to the economy would you expect from the proposed dam on the Upper Mississippi River?
Well, that is a big question. So I think it would be good for me to sit down and learn a little bit more about it, one. So it depends where it is, how, you know, there are a lot of things. Like Bhutan is a very interesting country, and they did more run-of-the-river dams, or it's not a dam, it's a run-of-the-river hydroelectric facility, which means it doesn't provide the same kind of flood risk reduction, and it doesn't provide as much electricity, but it doesn't damage as much the natural systems and such. And this is a big dam. This is going to be one of the biggest dams in the country. So I think it definitely deserves a lot of examination. Myself, I'd have to look at it, you know, much more closely. But in the long run, you know, if we could if we could take a look at Grand Coulee and build that differently than it had been built before, and that's a very important dam from my perspective. It was important for World War II because we created a lot of aluminum, and yet we paid no attention to salmon. We sure had a long-term cost on the loss of salmon, which is kind of mind-boggling and unmeasured in a lot of ways. So these choices, let me just say this. The choice about how you match built capital to natural capital is, I think, the most fundamental question of the 20th century. Just like in Louisiana, we're not saying don't have levees. You got to have some levees. But if you forget the wetlands, levees don't work. And the same with all of our built capital, we really carefully have to look at how natural and built capital fit together. Thanks.
Let's give David a great applause.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with David Batker, co-founder, executive director, and chief economist of Earth Economics. He gave the keynote address on ecosystem services, healthy communities, and healthy economies at this year's Matsu Salmon Science and Conservation Symposium. His talk was recorded at the Palmer Community Center on November 13, 2013. If you would like to listen to past keynotes at the Matsu Salmon Science and Conservation Symposium, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on today's show for links. Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online anytime at alaskapublic.org. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Platt. Thanks for listening.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.